Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, special podcast-only edition of the programme via the internet, via iTunes, etc., of a debate that took place a few weeks ago now between young apologist Callum Miller and old new atheist Peter Atkins. More on that in just a moment's time. Apologies if you are used to receiving something in your iTunes or your podcast feed every Saturday. This is a little overdue, coming midweek after the normal Saturday time. We had no radio show on the Saturday gone just because we had our special Together Now fundraising appeal going on. If you would like to contribute to that, it's still possible to do that. premier.org.uk/together now if you want to contribute to the ongoing financial needs of Premier Christian Radio. And, of course, it is your generous giving, which helps to support the work of Unbelievable. But beyond that, it was also, of course, Unbelievable, the conference 2012 last Saturday. So it's been rather busy at my end, and I haven't quite managed to put this podcast together because of it. So that's all finished. What a wonderful day we had. Thanks to everyone. If you're listening and you were there, thank you for coming. And thanks to everyone who took the time to say hi. It was just so wonderful to meet so many people who have been helped, encouraged in some way by the programme. And just great to put some faces to a few names as well of regular emailers, people who interact on the Facebook forums and that kind of thing. So thank you very much. And I should say that we will be making all the sessions available on a new DVD. So if you want to find out more, then do go to the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. At the time that I'm putting this together, we haven't quite updated the details of the DVD page, but we will be doing that very shortly so that you can pre-order the new triple DVD of this year's conference. And we also had a very successful series of events around the conference with our guests from the United States, Reasons to Believe. Ken Samples and Hugh Ross were with me, and we were doing various debates, lectures, speaking engagements. What a great time we had at the various venues we visited. Perhaps you were also at one or more of those. So thanks to everyone who's been involved in what's been rather a busy week or two in my schedule, and indeed in the Reasons to Believe UK tour schedule, as it were. But now turning to today's programme, I promised to put this on the podcast for because a number of people know Callum, who is a regular listener to this programme, but is a budding sort of apologist in many ways. In fact, he is an apologist, and a very good one at that too. So I went along to the debate that he had with Peter Atkins, who is, of course, a chemist, an Oxford academic, and, of course, a strong atheist. And he's been on the programme a few times before, whether in my studio or debating William Lane Craig. But what we're going to hear now is the debate that he had at Christ Church College in Oxford, simply on the question, does God exist? This was the first in a series of new debates that are being tried out between Oxford undergraduates and Oxford academics. And so Callum was selected to go up against Peter Atkins. And we'll hear towards the end of the programme some of the interviews I took with some members of the audience and the debate participants themselves. So keep listening out for that. This, though, has been available to watch as a video for some time on YouTube. So I'll post a link with the podcast of this programme to that as well, if you'd like to see it, as it were, in Technicolor. But for now, I'll leave it to the moderator of the evening, Michael Keenan Baldwin, to introduce the event and the guests who took part in this debate on the existence of God.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thank you and good evening. My name is Mahmoud Naji and I'm the organiser of this debate. It's a real delight to welcome you here to Christchurch. I hope you'll get plenty of intellectual nourishment tonight. I'd like to introduce to you the moderator for this debate, a second-year PPEist and real whiz kid when it comes to philosophy, Michael Baldwin.
Thank you, Mahmoud. And can I echo his warm welcome to you this evening? It's fantastic to see you all here, especially to see some people who've come from outside of Oxford, especially for tonight's debate. So a special welcome to Oxford to you. Tonight we'll be witnessing a debate on one of the most fascinating and profound questions which anyone can ask, and that is, does God exist? Answering yes to that question, on my near left, is Callum Miller, who is a third-year undergraduate medic at St Hugh's College and a rising young star in the world of Christian apologetics. He's on the UK staff team of apologetics.com, and he's the creator of the website dovetheology.com. Callum is well within his element, debating the questions such as one we're considering tonight, after presenting at the University of Oxford's Philosophy of Religion graduate seminar just this past Monday. Answering no to our question, to my far left, is Peter Atkins, who is the former professor of chemistry here at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Lincoln College. He's a prolific writer, and anyone here taking chemistry will be well familiar with his chemistry textbooks, in particular physical chemistry, inorganic chemistry, and molecular quantum mechanics. He's also the author of a number of popular science books aimed more for the general public, including Galileo's Finger, The 10 Great Ideas of Science. And he's also now a well-known advocate of atheism and secular humanism. So would you join me in welcoming tonight's debaters? Let me quickly paint a picture for you of what's going to be happening tonight. We're going to have opening speeches of 20 minutes each, starting with Callum, before having rebuttal speeches of 10 minutes each. We'll then have second rebuttal speeches of 8 minutes, before having closing speeches of 5 minutes. We'll then go into our more informal part of our programme, where we'll have 15 minutes of discussion between Professor Atkins and Callum, and then a bit of Q&A from the audience, if we have time remaining. So do be thinking about questions you might want to ask at that point. Could I also remind you to turn off any mobile phones that you have, not only to make sure it doesn't go off during the debate, but so that we don't get any interference with the mic system. I'd really appreciate that. My job tonight is just to make sure that none of the debaters speak out of turn, and that to make sure no one goes over their allotted time by even a split second. I'm going to ring this embarrassing little bell I've got over there, once when there's 30 seconds left, and twice when there's 10 seconds left, just to make sure we don't run out of time. Finally, could I ask you to refrain from clapping or shouting out while the speeches are ongoing, and simply to show your appreciation for our speakers after they finish each speech. So I think that's all the things I need to say. So enough from me. I'm going to invite Callum to come up and give his opening speech to us.
Well, it's a privilege to be speaking here tonight discussing this important question with you. I'd like to thank Mahmoud Naji, the Oxford Debates President, for organising this, and Professor Atkins for agreeing to take part. His commitment to education in giving his time to discuss with us lowly undergraduates is entirely commendable, so thank you. As a student of science, I've learnt the value of logical argument and evidence. I'm therefore going to be using standard principles of reasoning, evidence and logic in this debate, rather than relying on the inspiration of scripture or faith. Faith in a person or a cause may be justified, but we do not justify beliefs simply by appealing to it. Let me first say a brief word about what we mean by evidence. The eminent philosopher of science, Colin Howson, gives the standard definition. To say that a body of information is evidence in favour of a hypothesis is to say that the hypothesis receives some degree of support or confirmation from that information. And one can actually demonstrate using probability theory that an observation is evidence in favour of a hypothesis if the hypothesis makes the observation more likely than we would otherwise expect. As Papineau explains, this is pre-theoretically just what we would expect. For it says that evidence confirms a theory to the extent that the evidence is likely given the theory, but unlikely otherwise. If the evidence is in itself very surprising, like light bending in the vicinity of the sun, but at the same time just what you would expect given your theory, the general theory of relativity, then the evidence should make you increase your degree of belief in the theory a great deal. So then, Evidence for theism will be observations which we would expect if theism were true, but which would be less likely otherwise. And the strength of the evidence is proportional to how much more likely theism makes the data, and conversely with evidence for atheism. Now, note here the role of alternative hypotheses. Alternative hypotheses are often proposed in order to argue that certain features of the world don't constitute evidence for theism. But this is hardly a scientific approach. We don't argue that fossils aren't evidence for evolution because there are other possible explanations. That the devil put them there, for example. The fact that we can give other possible explanations of fossils is irrelevant, since we have no other very strong reason for thinking that these other explanations are true. So let's not be seduced by speculative alternatives to theism. Whether there are other possible explanations of the data in no way undermines the fact that the data may be evidence for theism. So, what is the evidence for theism? There's only limited time to give a few examples, and even these arguments are thus extremely attenuated, and I've given time to developing them and other arguments more rigorously elsewhere. There's a wide range of cogency, of course, with some less convincing arguments. This one you may be familiar with is the banana argument, or also known as the atheist's nightmare. You probably won't be convinced with that, but there are some more sophisticated ones as well. This is by the philosopher Robert Major. I'll save this in case I really get desperate, but hopefully we won't get there. So my first piece of evidence is the order of the universe and the fact that science is possible or reliable at all. Most reflective people have at some point asked the question, how do I know the laws of physics won't just change tomorrow? It's usually taken for granted in science that the future will be largely like the past, that the unobserved is like the observed. But this is really quite an incredible coincidence when one reflects on it. As the famous skeptic David Hume wrote, all inferences from experience are based on the assumption that the future will resemble the past. As soon as the suspicion is planted that the course of nature may change, so that the past stops being a guide to the future, all experience becomes useless and can't support any inference or conclusion. Attempts to provide a rational basis for this order and lawfulness have been notoriously unsuccessful and have even been exacerbated by the work of more recent philosophers such as Nelson Goodman. The atheist philosopher Norman Swartz puts the problem this way. Large-scale coincidences cry out for explanations that reveal the contrivance, planning or deliberation behind the phenomenon. There are probably more than 10 to the 60 electrons in the universe, and all of them, we may suppose, have precisely the same electrical charge. Now, although I am prepared to allow that 5 red cars in a row might be dismissed as a coincidence, can I allow that 10 to the 60 items with precisely the same electrical charge is likewise a coincidence? One thing we might do is swallow deeply and say, nothing at all accounts for this fact. Faced with the prospect of having to say this, many persons find the sheer contingency of the actual world utterly fantastic. If it wasn't God who designed all this and saw to it that all these countless particles are qualitatively identical, then something has to account for it. That 10 to the 60 things should all be alike in their properties cannot rationally be deemed just a coincidence. And so we have multiple problems here. It seems an enormous coincidence that the universe should be ordered at all, that it should conform to laws, that induction should be reliable, that the future should resemble the past, and that it should resemble the past in a particular way. No real reason can be given for this fundamental assumption of science on atheism, and so we should have no reason to expect it. Arguably, we have reason not to expect it. But on theism, we can give good reason for expecting this. A loving God would wish to create beings with the capacity for moral behaviour and who could develop science. These both require general order. I cannot attempt to cure you unless I know that this drug is likely to carry on curing people in the future. And of course, science itself, one of humanity's greatest achievements, would be utterly impossible without this uniformity and predictability. So we're faced with the questions, which worldview is this more likely on? Which worldview explains the success of science? Which is more conducive to science? It seems to me that an epistemology based purely on science cannot answer these questions. But yet, perhaps it suggests we can only have contentful knowledge by observation. But clearly we cannot believe in future order on this view. But yet science is entirely predicated on the assumption that the future will be like the past. Not only is this purely scientific epistemology quite erroneous in that sense, I think, it is also profoundly unable to account for the success of science. I conclude, therefore, that the order and the lawfulness of the universe, the success of science, and the reliability of induction constitute very strong evidence for theism. My second piece of evidence, then, is the existence of a life-permitting universe. In the last few decades, physicists have uncovered some fascinating truths showing that the basic features of the universe had to be extraordinarily fine-tuned to allow life. What this means is that the laws of physics, the values of certain constants in these laws, and the initial conditions of the universe had to be perfectly adjusted in a tiny range of possible values and conditions for life to have evolved. The astronomer royal Martin Rees writes, "The outcome depended crucially on a recipe encoded in the Big Bang, and this recipe seems to have been rather special. A degree of fine-tuning in the expansion speed, the material content of the universe, and the strengths of the basic forces seems to have been a prerequisite for the emergence of the hospitable cosmic habitat in which we live." Or see Paul Davis, formerly at Cambridge. "There is now broad agreement among physicists and cosmologists that the universe is in several respects fine-tuned for life." The examples are well known, and I haven't time to go into too much detail here, but it is worth just giving an example of the magnitude of improbability here. With respect to the initial conditions of the universe, the Oxford atheist physicist Roger Penrose writes, "In order to produce a universe resembling the one in which we live, the creator would have to aim for an absurdly tiny volume of the phase space of possible universes." Penrose then argues that the probability of this arising by chance is 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power, a number far smaller than the ratio of the size of a proton to the size of the entire observable universe. The strength of gravity and the value of the cosmological constant are two other examples. Robin Collins writes, "If the strength of gravity were smaller or larger by an estimated 1 part in 10 to the 60 of its current value, the universe would have either exploded too quickly for galaxies and stars to form, or collapsed back on itself too quickly for life to evolve. Without fine-tuning or some new principle of physics, the cosmological constant is expected to be at least 10 to the 53 to 10 to the 120th power times larger than the maximum life-permitting value." The smallness of the cosmological constant compared to its non-fine-tuned, theoretically expected value is widely regarded as the single greatest problem confronting current physics and cosmology. With a good few parameters fine-tuned to such extraordinary degrees, then, we can give an extraordinarily low value to the probability of a life-permitting universe on atheism. Of course, an extremely low probability by itself means nothing, so we have to compare it with the probability of a life-permitting universe on theism. Again, however, we have good reason to suppose that a loving God would create a universe permitting the existence of relational, moral agents. And so we can give at least a moderate probability to this. It then follows, once again, that we have another piece of very strong evidence for theism. My final datum tonight is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. There are some facts surrounding Jesus' life which the majority of New Testament historians, Christian or non-Christian, accept as almost certainly true. I will call these the resurrection facts. These include that Jesus was crucified, was buried, and that shortly after his crucifixion, his disciples had experiences of him, leading them to believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead, a belief they were willing to die for. With respect to the first of these facts, John Dominic Crossan, though he doesn't believe in the resurrection, writes, "Jesus' death by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate is as sure as anything historical can ever be." And with respect to the disciples' experiences, the leading German atheist New Testament historian, Gerd Ludermann, writes, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ." Jesus' tomb was also found empty by a group of women on the third day, as the late atheist historian at Cambridge, Michael Grant, writes. If we apply the same sort of criteria that we would apply to any other ancient literary sources, then the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was indeed found empty. Moreover, several skeptics, including Paul and James, Jesus' brother, became convinced of Jesus' resurrection, so convinced that they were willing to die for this belief. I do not have time to explain the reasons historians hold these facts to be almost certainly historical here, but suffice to say that any satisfactory account of Jesus' life must be able to explain these. The questions that arise then are, what could have caused this belief in these people, a belief so contrary to everything they believed about the world? And what could account for the appearances to the disciples and for the discovered empty tomb? Attempts to explain these facts without invoking the resurrection have been almost universally rejected. Now, obviously, I can't go through each of these alternatives now, so I'll leave it to anyone else to propose something plausible. Now again, even this strong evidence would not necessarily be very convincing on its own. We would like, if possible, some context in which to make sense of such a miracle, and some reason for God performing it, so as to make theism the best explanation of these data. And I think we can give such reasons. Let's start with reasons God might become human. A perfectly good God would have ample reason to become human. One reason would be to identify with humans and share in their suffering. Indeed, I think many of us would feel God compelled to become human on this account alone. Other reasons might be to provide atonement, to reveal his character more obviously and fully, to set an example, and to provide information and encouragement. If we want to collect evidence for and against theism, therefore, we ought to see whether anyone plausibly fits this description. We ought to be open to this possibility of God becoming human and take seriously pertinent claims. Now, it seems to me evident that if Jesus was God, then he fulfilled all these roles. He underwent enormous suffering, taught his atonement, gave radical teaching which has transformed the world, and provided inspiration for innumerable lives. All of these constitute small pieces of evidence and things to take into consideration. But I also think there are good historical grounds for thinking he implied his divinity and predicted his resurrection. Now, there are typically only three types of people who do this kind of thing: those who are insane, those who are frauds, and those who are God. Obviously, the latter category is a small one consisting of zero or one people. But it seems to me evident that Jesus was not a fraud. Frauds give up when they're about to be crucified, generally. But nor does it seem plausible that Jesus was mad. We have here no indicator of any of the psychiatric conditions which give people a God complex. We have profound teaching which changed the world, and we have a compassionate, understanding, insightful character. So this gives us more reason to take very seriously the evidence or possible evidence for the resurrection. Now, it seems to me that the main reason we don't normally count evidence for a particular miracle as evidence for God is because we don't have good reason to think God would perform this particular miracle. But in this case, we have very good reason to think so. The compelling figure of Jesus seems to be precisely the kind of person whose life and teaching God would want to vindicate. And so, given that Jesus fits the mould of what we would expect from a God become human, and given the implausibility of alternative accounts of who he was, I think we can say that, if God existed, we would moderately expect the resurrection facts to obtain. But given the inadequacy of alternative hypotheses, the resurrection fact obtaining is overwhelmingly unlikely on atheism. It seems clear to me that on these facts alone, the best explanation of all these data is that Jesus was raised from the dead by God. But at the very least, I think we can say that the resurrection facts constitute evidence for God. So let me close with a few comments about what I think Professor Atkins needs to offer us, and about the notorious burden of proof. Firstly, proof is too strong. We rarely look for proof in science. Instead, we look to see where the evidence points and what is most probable. And so I think we should be discussing the burden of justification rather than the burden of proof. The atheist often tries to avoid any burden by saying that one can never disprove the existence of anything. But I think this is unpersuasive for two main reasons. Firstly, we can disprove certain things. A married bachelor, for example, is logically incoherent and so cannot exist. And this is non-trivial. A good number of philosophers and scientists have aimed to show that God is similarly incoherent, the example of which is given here with several philosophers and scientists trying to do exactly that. But secondly, I'm not asking anyone to disprove God. I'm asking, rather, for a logical argument as to why theism is improbable, or for evidence against theism. We frequently provide evidence against the existence of things in science. We are reasonably sure that there is no large black hole near our solar system because we have the evidence of our continued existence against it. And again, many have argued that certain features of the universe, suffering for example, constitute evidence against theism. Indeed, Professor Atkins has himself endorsed this on previous occasions. And so even if there was no evidence for theism, which we have seen, I hope, isn't the case, it would not follow logically that God does not exist, or even that God probably does not exist. But if we don't have a logical argument or evidence for God's improbability, then all we're left with is assertion. And, as Professor Atkins himself writes, all assertions are unreliable unless founded on publicly accessible evidence. Science has no truck with assertion. We need, therefore, to look at the evidence and reasoning for and against any position and see which is most rationally warranted. In the absence of any evidence either way, and in the absence of any argument for why theism should be a priori improbable, it seems to me that we should refrain from asserting either that God probably does exist or that he probably doesn't. We should stick with agnosticism and say we simply don't have much of an idea, Many of us do this with alien life, for example. Why not with God? And so, in conclusion, note that giving ad hoc, complex, speculative, unevidenced, and themselves improbable alternative hypotheses to explain these facts will do nothing whatsoever to undermine my case. And this is for three main reasons. Firstly, because the possibility of alternative hypotheses does not mean that the data are not evidence for theism, and I explained this at the start. Secondly, because there are plenty of arguments I have not time to hint at tonight, such as the one I showed you earlier. But thirdly, because science seeks to explain coincidences, and to explain a wide range of coincidences in the simplest way possible. Otherwise known as Occam's razor, the atheist philosopher of science Eliot Sober writes, "This venerable principle says that hypotheses that postulate fewer entities, causes, or processes are to be preferred over hypotheses that postulate more. Occam's razor expresses the idea that a theory that provides a unified, common treatment of different phenomena is preferable to a theory that treats each phenomenon as a separate and independent problem." So I think in order to argue that God probably doesn't exist, Professor Atkins needs to reject at least one premise in each of my arguments, and also to give some evidence or a logical argument of his own to demonstrate that theism is improbable. Until then, I think we have at least reason to be agnostic, and very good reason to accept theism. As you listen tonight, therefore, I encourage you to continually ask the questions: who has presented more evidence for their position? Who has presented arguments for why certain features of the universe would constitute evidence? Whose hypothesis best explains the data and best makes sense of science? And whose does so in the most parsimonious way? I hope you will conclude that, by far, theism fulfills these criteria best. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that very interesting presentation. It is my duty just to lay out my own thoughts at this stage, but you will see that I've anticipated some of the points made by Callum already, but I will try to distinguish the rebuttal from the presentation. And I'll begin, really, I think, by admitting defeat. I really cannot prove, as Callum implied, that God does not exist. Everything there is could be the creation of an extraordinary entity that surpasses our understanding and will do forevermore, except perhaps when we're dead. It could be that the universe was created only a millisecond ago, with all our memories suddenly but falsely in place. And it could be, as God is outside time, whatever that meaningless phrase actually means, that he hasn't decided to make us yet. It is conceivable that God did indeed create the universe 13.7 billion years ago. One might wonder why he chose that moment to do it. And I cannot prove that he didn't. All I can do is to assemble evidence that, and it is evidence, that leads to the conclusion that God is not necessary for any aspect of the current world, and that there is a far simpler explanation for everything than the assertion of the existence of an omnipotent God. Now, I have to say, of course, that many people hold the view that the assertion that God made it, as we just heard, is far, far simpler as an explanation of everything than a more pedestrian account in terms of physical laws. God, they say, is surely a simpler explanation than complex mechanism. But don't be seduced by that view. The assertion that God did anything is simplistic rather than simple, and it is lazy. It is simplistic because an entity as functionally unbounded as a God must be of extraordinary complexity. And the shortness of a name does not imply the simplicity of an entity. It's lazy because it avoids becoming involved in untangling the web of events that have led to us. any argument that simply asserts that God did it is a sign of a lazy mind, a mind that is content to wallow in assertion rather than embark upon climbing the intellectual Everest of comprehension. My argument against God, I hope he's not listening, is that there is nothing in the universe that cannot be explained, in prospect at least, without invoking that complex hypothesis. In other words, yes, use Occam's razor, cut it down, cut away all the accretions of theology, and let science speak for itself. In other words, there are simpler explanations, or at least the prospect of simpler explanations, for absolutely everything. Because there are simpler explanations, or the prospect of them, and I admit that prospect of them is a weasel word, which I will be happy to defend later, there is no need to burden our understanding with the assertion that there is something more, namely an incomprehensible God. And that billions of people believe the contrary is of no consequence. Truth is not arrived at by a majority vote. There are clearly huge psychological and cultural pressures imposed on people from an early age, and belief has been honed by the powerful into a potent weapon of crowd control. In the nasty, brutish brevity of an impoverished life, great comfort comes from the belief that there is better to come. There is also satisfaction that wrongdoers, wealthy and arrogant perhaps on earth, will get their comeuppance in the afterlife. Even the meek are in with a chance. Angst and hope, angst at the prospect of one's own annihilation and hope for unbounded ecstasy to come, are potent drivers into the jaws of belief. But the potency of the drivers and the huge majority of the hoopers does not mean that the belief is correct. Now, I've made a strong but carefully worded claim that there is nothing in the universe that cannot be explained or has the prospect of being explained without invoking God. And I need to justify that claim. If you accept my argument that a God is unnecessary, then your only recourse, if you insist on believing that there is a God, is to admit that you are driven by your heart rather than your head. But hearts are unreliable organs of knowledge. Is it your right auricle speaking or your left ventricle? Which one is doing the understanding? Even if by heart you mean sentimental wishful thinking, then that too is wholly unreliable. Callum wanted me to deal with 3 points. I shall deal with 3 and add 3 of my own. I shall deal with contingency, fitness, purpose, miracles, including resurrections, theodicy, and morality. Obviously, perhaps mercifully, I don't have time to go through any of these topics in any great detail, but perhaps by setting up the ground, we can return to finer arguments later. In each case, I shall argue that modern science, the agent of the new Enlightenment, promises, and I often offer no more than that, to elucidate what theology has for so long obscured. First, contingency. Science currently doesn't have the slightest clue about how a universe can come into existence out of absolutely nothing without intervention. I will leave aside whether the universe is eternal in some sense without a beginning. That is something to be determined by observation, not by the ruminations of philosophy. You simply don't know. To make it harder for myself, I shall suppose for the sake of argument that there was a beginning. There are 2 kinds of beginning, of course, and it's important to distinguish them. One type of beginning is when an already existing universe, such as this, gives rise to a daughter universe. Another type of beginning is when absolutely nothing turns into a universe. I shall call that universe an original universe. Now, some assert that a universe can spring from a quantum fluctuation. That may be true for a daughter universe. For an already existing mother universe has physical laws and a richly propertied vacuum. But when there is absolutely nothing, there are no physical laws. So a quantum fluctuation is an empty term for the emergence of an original universe. So to make things harder for myself, but with an eye on trying to answer and not evade a deeply important question, I shall set aside the simpler problem of a daughter universe and consider the formation of the original universe. Did the ancestor universe, although perhaps contingent, have to be caused? You have to realise that physical laws, which are summaries of observed behaviour, come into existence as a universe comes into existence. That includes issues of causality. It is naive in the extreme to extrapolate our own experience of causality, which is essentially the working out of the consequences of physical laws, to an era before those laws existed. It is entirely possible that the unique event that marked the inception of the physical laws was itself an uncaused event. What science has to do in due course is to discover how absolutely nothing can tumble into something. There's no doubt that it's edging towards that goal by burrowing back into time to discover what went on immediately after the creation event. And look how far it has come in the past 100 years. We're starting to be confident about what first appeared, and we are certainly becoming aware of what needs to be known, such as refinements and replacements of general relativity and quantum theory. And once we know the nature of the newly formed universe, we can begin to speculate, as some already have, about the nature of the events that has given us the impression that there is something here in place of absolutely nothing. To say that we now have any knowledge at all about how it could happen would be a lie. But to say at this stage, and after so much progress, that God did it, would be a premature admission of defeat. There is currently no need for a creator God. Secondly, fitness. One role for God, it is argued, as we heard, is to choose the values of the fundamental constants so that we images of him can emerge. I will discount the evidence that God has an apparently greater interest in ensuring the presence of gas and rocks than of organisms, and concede the fact that this universe has properties that allow the emergence of life. But there are two principal arguments that throw into doubt the view that a thoughtful God was involved in the design of the universe. First, it could be the case that only a certain mix of fundamental constants could come into existence in a viable universe, and the fact that they allow life is just a happy accident. Why, what's so special about life? Second, it could be the case, and theoretical models give some credence to it, that ours is not the only universe. And if there is more than one universe, then there is no obvious reason why there is not an infinite number of universes. Why stop at two? Why stop at 42? It could be that all those universes have some mix of fundamental constants, each one allowing life. Or it could be that the fundamental constants take random values, and it's inevitable that one, and perhaps even an infinity of them, permit the emergence of life. No design appears to be necessary, and an argument that posits an essential designer God is lazy rather than convincing. There is currently no need for a designer God. Purpose. Philosophers and their obfuscating cousins, the theologians, have puzzled for centuries about the purpose of the universe. Why did God make it? Boredom with absolutely nothing? Anxious for admirers? Keen that we should have the pleasures and indeed the pains of existence? The trouble is, there is absolutely no evidence that the universe has any purpose whatsoever. This, like causality, is an extrapolation of puny human experience to an inappropriate cosmic scale. Each of us has purposes of various kinds, and so surely the universe must have a purpose too. Science proceeds to elucidate the workings of the world without invoking purpose, and finds not one jot of evidence for it. In fact, in my view, there is a grandeur in an entity as big as the universe just hanging there, totally uselessly. Miracles. I shall adopt the perhaps naive but common view that a miracle involves the suspension of natural law. Miracles of that kind have never occurred. There is not one atom of reliable evidence that God ever intervened in the world to suspend his laws. That the path to canonization requires physicians to certify that an event cannot be explained except by God responding to intercession by a candidate saint should result in the physicians being struck off for incompetence. Even that great pivotal purported miracle, the resurrection, is a total fabrication, with other explanations far more cogent than anything divine. Even given that Jesus existed and was crucified, was he merely in a coma? Was his disappearance a cover-up for political reasons? Was it Golgotha Gate? Did the women forget which of the many post-crucifixion holes in the ground he was buried in? The Gospels are wholly unreliable, being politically motivated propaganda manifestos written long after the events that they purport to report. And as no miracle has ever occurred, to assert that miracles are evidence for God is an empty argument. Theodicy. That an all-loving God permits evil to stalk the world, including that unconscious evil of evolution by natural selection, has puzzled theologians since the beginning of time, and all manner of convoluted explanations have been proposed. There is, of course, an extraordinarily simple explanation. There is no all-loving God. Indeed, to anyone with an open mind, the existence of evil, the torment, accident, and neighbour visit upon the innocent, is in fact evidence against the existence of God. Sixthly, morality. God is commonly presumed to be the fountainhead of love, and as such the source of the distinction between good and evil. In my view, the distinction has emerged in the course of evolutionary history. But morality is not only the consequence of red in tooth and claw. It's red in tooth and claw coated in the milk of human kindness, in the form of our emerging ability to consider the consequences of our actions. To discover the roots of ethics, we might consult the so-called holy books for a variety of anecdotes and experiences that might match our own. But to understand the source of the distinction, we need to examine our ethological history, perhaps history itself, and certainly anthropology and psychology. Just as good manners have emerged for the sake of decorum and the avoidance of offence, so good behaviour has emerged for the sake of survival. It is childish to presume that there is an umpire God and adult to consider that our actions stabilise society. I consider some of the arguments that purport to establish the existence of God and have shown that they carry little force. In every case, there is a more cogent, or at least the likelihood of a more cogent explanation. That holy books are not evidence for a God, despite the claims of believers. They are edited anthologies, packed with error and self-contradiction. They might be a delight to read and might even provide solace for those tossed on the stormy seas of life. They might even provide insight into the human condition and hint at historical events. But to ascribe to them the idea that they are the word of God is a step too far, and normally taken by those who wish to acquire authority for a particularly repressive view, such as the subjugation of women, dire punishment, intolerance of abortion and homosexuality, and human liberty in general. The existence of holy books is a weapon of control, not evidence for a God. I can understand why the notion of God has arisen and persisted, for it provides a simple purported explanation of great matters. It is a comfort blanket for the anxious and deprived, and it is a powerful weapon of crowd control. And you have a choice. You have a choice to accept on faith that there is a God and lie back, luxuriating in the foam of satisfaction that there is no longer any way, any further need to think. For why pursue the incomprehensible further than by comforting assertion? Or you might take delight in the power of the collective human intellect, an intellect that burrows into experience, is in hot pursuit of comprehension, and indeed for comprehension on this side of the grave, and adds to life the delight of true understanding. It is my view that there is absolutely no need for a self-deceiving intellectual laziness that we call belief in God. Thank you.
Well, obviously I've given some arguments at the start for my position, so I'll just start with addressing some of Professor Atkins's arguments. I said at the start that we have, well, perhaps some people have tried to prove atheism, some people have tried to prove theism. I don't think theism can be disproven in such a way, and it seems Professor Atkins agrees, so we can be agreed upon that, I think, for a start. But you'll notice I said we should also be we should perhaps expect arguments against theism, or for evidence against theism. And thankfully, Professor Atkins has obliged with that and has offered us some possible arguments against theism in that respect. Note that we also both share a disdain for taking things purely on blind faith. We're looking at evidence, and that's what I've tried to present in my opening talk. So I think we're also agreed there. Similarly, the burden of proof point I was talking about seems to have been tacitly accepted. We both argue that we need evidence or arguments for our position, and again, Professor Atkins has tried to do that. So let me try and begin with what Professor Atkins' arguments were. I think his first main one was that God was not necessary to explain anything. But of course, this doesn't show that God doesn't exist. I mean, my parents are perhaps not necessary to explain my existence. I might have come into existence from absolutely nothing. Who knows? But that doesn't obviously show that they don't exist. To argue otherwise would seem to me to be absurd. But also, it seems to me that, well, perhaps other things might not be able to be explained by science. But even if they can't, for example, moral values or science itself, even if they can't, I'm not arguing that God is necessary to explain anything. I'm arguing that there is evidence for God, and that some data are more likely on theism than otherwise. And this doesn't seem to have been addressed. It's characteristic of science to posit things, perhaps which we don't see as necessary to explain a phenomenon, but nevertheless we still see them as a good explanation. So I don't think this objection really holds any weight at all. Now, Professor Atkins then argues that there is, in prospect, at least a simpler explanation. And I've tried in my opening speech to give perhaps a little piece of what it means for an explanation to be simple. It postulates few entities, few properties of entities, and so on. But it seems to me that theism fulfills these criteria. It posits one entity with only a few properties and infinite degrees of those properties, omnipotence, omniscience, and personality. And so it seems to me, therefore, to posit Occam's razor. You'll note that one of his responses to the fine-tuning argument was to postulate a multiverse of trillions and trillions of universes. Well, it seems to me obvious which of these explanations for the fine-tuning is more parsimonious. Professor Atkins also offered the argument that theism is a simplistic explanation. It just says, God did it. I actually agree. It is simplistic in a sense. But I think Professor Atkins is wrong in thinking that this implies that we shouldn't pursue science as well. Take Newton's law of gravity, for example. This says that that massive bodies will attract each other with a force proportional to the distance between them and their mass, and so on. But obviously, this doesn't explain how it attracts each other. It was only at the 20th century where Albert Einstein was able to talk about the curvature of space-time and general relativity that we actually had a mechanism. All I was arguing was that some phenomena are more likely on theism than otherwise. The mechanism of those is left open to science, and I'm happy to leave scientists to do that. Indeed, I am a scientist. I think some features of the world are more likely on theism, but that doesn't mean that I don't look for the mechanisms supporting that. I'm a doctor. If I just said, well, God did it, or a demon did it, I'd probably be fired, and rightly so. So I think that this objection is unpersuasive as well. And obviously, Professor Atkins also offered a few thoughts about philosophy and theology. I'm not going to talk about that, but I would note that I'm a scientist at this university, and since Professor Atkins is on the educational team at this university, if I can't do science, it's his fault. So I don't think any of these arguments against theism are particularly persuasive. It's not a lazy explanation, because we're staying agnostic as to the mechanism of how God does things. You'll notice I simply asked and suggested theism makes these data more probable than otherwise. So the arguments, I don't think, hold weight. There are a couple more points that he offered, such that religion was invented for crowd control. Well, I don't think this is the case in the resurrection, simply because most of the early Christians died for it. They weren't very good at controlling crowds. So again, I'm not sure this is particularly convincing. And the origin of the universe, he says, well, science can explain how the universe came to be, perhaps. I won't go into that argument at all, so I think we'll probably leave it there and tacitly agree it for the premise of the debate. Now, he offered some... I mean, it was difficult for him because he had no knowledge of my opening speech before he arrived here today. But let me just give a few thoughts defending my arguments and his objections to some of them. Well, it doesn't seem to me that the argument from order and the success of science was really addressed at all. Professor Atkins has seemed to argue from present success here, but I'm not sure this is particularly persuasive. After all, Professor Atkins elsewhere writes, if I can just find it, sorry. He writes, I am aware that present success, extrapolation from present success, is not a convincing argument. So I don't think this will really help us in explaining the order of the universe. And it doesn't seem to me, since science presupposes that order and lawfulness of the universe, that science is in any position to be able to explain that. So I think the argument from order still stands. For the fine-tuning arguments I offered, again, I'm not sure the objections are particularly persuasive. One objection he offered was that the universe was necessary. Well, perhaps, but this doesn't seem to object to any particular premise in my formulation of the argument. Moreover, why can we not simply say it about anything else in the world? We could say, why did that tree fall over? Oh, perhaps the physical laws of nature had to be that way. That doesn't explain our understanding. Professor Atkins and myself are both interested in illuminating and elucidating our understanding of the way the world works. And to suggest that something is just necessary doesn't seem to me to constitute a very good hypothesis for that. And indeed, it would suffocate the other scientific suggestions for why the universe is fine-tuned in that way. So again, I don't think that's very convincing either. He offered the multiverse, which I alluded to earlier. This, perhaps, is a possibility. Notice that that's irrelevant. I said in my opening speech that alternative hypotheses, perhaps they're true, perhaps they're not. But they're not very relevant to talking about whether some data are evidence for a proposition. I argued that a fine-tuned universe is unlikely on atheism and likely on theism. The possibility of a multiverse doesn't seem to object to any of those premises at all. If anything, it seems to me to grossly violate Occam's razor, to violate the simplicity in a way that theism, I think, quite palpably doesn't. And so I'm not convinced that this is particularly persuasive either. There are multiple other problems with the multiverse. For example, there's no evidence really for it, I don't think. And some theoretical models which perhaps predict a multiverse are themselves very speculative things like string theory, M theory. Again, most would agree that there's not really many observations that have confirmed those. And so I think it's pure speculation to simply appeal to an explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe simply by appealing to this ad hoc, contrived, metaphysically completely extravagant hypothesis. And so I don't think we'll be satisfied with that. Indeed, I would argue that some possible reasons for thinking a multiverse exists, like inflationary cosmology and so on, actually make the problem worse. And this is a question really being worked on by a lot of physicists at the moment. So, for example, inflation makes the problem worse by postulating an entropy increasing process. But as I said in my opening speech, one of the fine-tuning problems is that the universe was initially in a very low entropy state. So to appeal to an entropy increasing process to explain the fine-tuning seems to me to be counterproductive, since the initial state will then have to be even more special than it originally was. Finally, there are a few observations on the argument from the resurrection and arguments from miracles. Professor Atkin suggests that these are political propaganda not to be trusted at all. Apparently, becoming outcasts from the start of a religion's origin and ending up as martyrs, being killed, crucified, whatever, is a fantastic political move. I wasn't aware of this, and so, I mean, you don't really see it in Parliament today. Perhaps that's because members of Parliament aren't very competent. I'll leave that question up to you. But it doesn't seem to me that the Gospels are in that kind of insincere motive, given the evidence we have for their martyrdom and so on. There's simply no evidence for the Gospels being political propaganda. There's no evidence for them being used this way in the first 2 centuries of their existence. Disciples were martyred and so on. And so I think, all in all, it seems to me that not only are Professor Atkins's arguments for atheism unpersuasive, indeed I can't see what logical rule of inference it would follow from that atheism was true, but I also think that my arguments stand intact for theism and that we have good reason to accept it. Thank you.
So now to Professor Atkins for his first rebuttal of 10 minutes.
Well, I think I have to go back to Callum's opening remarks, if this is to be in the form of a formal debate. And I do remember that he made 3 points. One concerned the fact that the universe was comprehensible, effectively. Correct me if I mistake, that his explanation for that, of course, is that there is a policeman God, a God that we will never understand, and indeed is of such simplicity that he can do everything. I wonder if science can actually say anything about the reason why the universe is comprehensible. And I think it really boils down to a couple of points. One is why mathematics proves to be such a potent way of understanding the workings of the universe and exploring the consequences of the physical laws. And another is to think about the origin of the physical laws themselves. Where did they come from? Is it conceivable that science can begin to identify the source of physical laws? I think it can. I'll give you 2 examples. One is a straightforward example, which is one physical law is that light travels in straight lines. Okay, I simplify, of course, but that's the nature of this evening. Why does light travel in straight lines? According to Callum, because God said so. That thou shalt travel in straight lines, he laid down at the beginning of the universe. But a scientist says, I know that light is a wave motion. And suppose I impose nothing on its behaviour whatsoever. I take this point, and I want to get to that point. How does light know that it should travel in a straight line? It doesn't. Let's suppose that light travels in every conceivable direction from its source, and arrives over here from all the conceivable paths that it could take. Because light is a wave motion, when it arrives by that path, it has a certain amplitude. When it arrives by a neighbouring path, it has a different amplitude, and they wipe each other out. But light that travels along a straight line has neighbours such that the amplitudes nearly match. So what happens is that if we allow complete freedom of action, we impose no law at all, it turns out that light travels in straight lines. In other words, we get a law of nature. So from anarchy, not from deity, do we get a law of nature. Look more deeply at that. One of the reasons why, you know, we can understand the world, and it doesn't fly apart, and doesn't, you know, just spurt off in all possible directions, is because energy is conserved. Energy is the great policeman of physics by allowing changes only if its value in the whole universe does not change. Where does the law of the conservation of energy come from? I don't want to be too technical, but there is a deep connection between symmetry and conservation. If it turns out that if you do the maths, that if time is uniform, then energy is conserved. Why is time uniform? Why is time tick, 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 and not tick, 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 and so on? Well, suppose the universe emerged from nothing. So there's absolutely nothing. Presumably there was total uniformity. If you've got nothing, it must be uniform. But when the universe came into existence, suppose nothing happened at all, so diminishing the role for a god, then that uniformity survives, and so time is uniform. And because time is uniform, energy is conserved. We get the great policeman of causality. So I'm not pretending that we scientists know where the laws come from, but I'm trying to convey the sense that we're beginning to scratch away at them. And when we scratch away at them, trying to look for their source, we don't need a deity. The second point that you made was the fittingness of the universe. I've dealt with that. I do think that billions, trillions, an infinite number of universes tumbling into existence at random is actually a very simple concept, and much simpler than the concept of an organising, engineering god. I would like to ask Callum in his riposte how many cogs his god has, how many pistons, how many levers, by what principles does he influence the workings of the world. To claim that God is a simple explanation is a typical theologian's obfuscation. It's a misrepresentation of what is meant by simplicity. Miracles, of which the resurrection is the most potent. Of course they died around that time, and someone called Joshua, namely Jesus or whatever, probably was crucified at that time. I do believe that Jesus, at least in the way that he is represented in the Gospels, is probably a very nice man who said some quite remarkable things, if he said anything at all. I mean, one of the theories that was not mentioned this evening is that he is just a kind of composite image of a rabbi. I can't believe that you, as a medical student, believe, for example, in the virgin birth. Do you?
Yeah.
You believe in the virgin birth?
Yeah.
I strongly, if you go into gynecology, I strongly urge you not to take too much notice of Callum's administrations. How can a modern scientist, not that doctors are scientists, I suppose, they're bedside, believe in such nonsense? It's because they've been brainwashed, and they have to believe in it because the Gospels say so. Jesus was inspiring, so was Sherlock Holmes. Jesus, the disciples, it is reported, although no one can take this as, I was going to say, gospel truth, but that has an ironical ring to it, of course. No one could really say that they had seen Jesus walking around after he was crucified, unless, of course, he was just in a coma, which is a very likely possibility. People saw Elvis. But, you know, we don't revere Elvis, or we don't hold him up as one of God's inspirations. It's Speaking of inspiration, we were told that Jesus must exist because he is so inspiring. So was Sherlock Holmes. But, you know, you really have to distinguish fantasy and imagination and the way that it can impact on people's lives from the actuality of existence. And, of course, the Gospels were political manifestos. They were written well after the events that they purport to describe. They were obviously engineered. And to claim that they are historically valid is really beyond what we're talking about this evening, namely belief. It comes down, I think, really to Occam's razor. That's what it's all about, frankly, this evening. Either you would say that, yes, we're going to, well, I'm sure, maybe all of us say we're going to look for the simplest explanation. You have the theological simple explanation of an omnipotent, all-powerful, omnicompetent, omniscient God. That's stretching the word simple, in my view. And you also, on the other hand, have the fact that we scientists are honest as far as we can be, and we're struggling to understand, and we're working towards it. And we have discovered an extraordinary method, the scientific method, for teasing out what we believe to be the truth about the workings and origin of the universe. I think you should give us time. I'm asking for time, but I promise you it will be comprehension this side of the grave and not on the other side.
Thank you. And now for Callum's second rebuttal, which is going to be 8 minutes long.
So Professor Atkins has addressed my three arguments, and I think he's actually done a reasonably good job. I'd add a disclaimer at the beginning that I'm not going to go into obs and gyne, so you can feel safe that I'll diagnose you correctly. I'm hoping to be a psychiatrist, which you may think I need myself, but who knows? We'll talk about that later. So my first argument was from the order of the universe, the lawfulness of the universe. Professor Atkins suggests science can illuminate this. I think so too. I think lots of laws can be explained by simpler laws. For example, Newton's law of gravity follows from some of the parts of general relativity, and general relativity explains that relatively well. So of course science can illuminate it, and I never suggested that we should simply halt progress at all and simply just say God did it. Indeed, I emphasised this in my first rebuttal, that we can still look for explanations. We can see how, for example, drinking alcohol leads to liver damage. Because we haven't necessarily given a mechanism for how alcohol damages the liver, doesn't mean that alcohol doesn't damage the liver or that it's a bad explanation. It just means it's true, but we need to look at that more carefully. And I think, similarly, we can do that with God. We can say God explains these data, but we can still use science, which God supports, to understand how he did it. So really, I'm not seeing a conflict there. We've heard assertions, I think, that I'm committed to believing simply that God did it. But that's really not the case. That's not what I said. We should still use science. The question is which worldview best grounds this belief in science. And it doesn't seem to me that there's any explanation on atheism why that should be the case. But of course, if theism is true, we have good reason to do it. And that's what I argued in my opening speech. So I'm not convinced that this, I suppose I would have to say it's a straw man of my position from the argument of order. I think we've perhaps talked past each other and not explained our positions carefully enough. Perhaps that's my fault. The fine-tuning argument, Professor Atkins suggests that trillions of universes perhaps is a good explanation, a simple explanation. He seems to have dropped the kind of necessity explanation, which I agree with. I would drop it as well. But I'm still not convinced that this trillions of universes explanation is really a simple one. First of all, remember my point in my opening speech, the role of alternative hypotheses. Just because there are other possibilities, like a multiverse, doesn't mean that the datum isn't evidence for theism. And I that seems to have been agreed upon. So I'm not sure why anyone would still say there is no evidence. We would just perhaps, at most, say that the evidence isn't particularly strong. But I think it is, because I don't think there's very good reason to think that a multiverse exists at all. There are multiple problems with it. As Atkins agrees that we're on, we are committed to the principle of Occam's razor, which says that one shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity. He asks, how many levers, how many cogs does God have? Well, none, and that's why I think it's simple. And it's a simpler explanation than the multiverse hypothesis, which postulates trillions, trillions, even trillions isn't enough, actually, to account for it. And so I think it seems to me, at least, perfectly clear which explanation is the simpler. Again, that's not to say we shouldn't look at mechanisms for how God might have done that. But it is to say that it's more expected on theism than otherwise. And so I'm not sure how theism is supposed to be a misrepresentation of simplicity. Professor Atkins has argued this, but I'm still not really sure what's the case. Perhaps we'll have to discuss what simplicity is a bit more. But I've given account of this. It's a matter of postulating few entities, few properties of entities, and very simple properties. And it seems to me, again, that theism fulfills these best far better than a multiverse. There are other problems with a multiverse, of course, such as the one I alluded to earlier. The only theoretical model that really gives a suggestion for why the multiverse might be true, inflationary cosmology, makes the problem worse. And so, for example, Roger Penrose writes, if I can just find it again, sorry. Indeed, it is fundamentally misconceived to explain why the universe is special in any particular respect by appealing to a thermalization process, such as inflation. But if the thermalization is actually doing anything, then it represents a definite increase of entropy. Thus, the universe would have had to be more special before the thermalization than after. This only serves to increase whatever difficulty we might have had previously in trying to come to terms with the initial, extraordinarily special nature of the universe. Invoking arguments from thermalization to address this particular problem is worse than useless. And so I think there really are multiple problems with this. I mean, if Professor Atkins wants to extend my argument by appealing to a poorly evidenced, speculative, metaphysically extravagant theory, then he's my guest. I welcome that if he wants to kind of emphasize my argument more, but I'm not personally convinced. And so there are these problems with the multiverse as well. There are other problems such as Boltzmann's brains, which I don't have time to get into now, but safe to say there are plenty of objections, which we might get to later. Finally, Professor Atkins addressed my argument from the resurrection. And, well, he says Jesus was a nice man. I agree. That was part of my point. So, again, we're agreed there. Professor Atkins argues that this is clearly a composite picture of rabbis, but I don't think this is the case. There are plenty of marks of dissimilarity between Jesus' ministry and reports of Jesus' ministry compared with previous rabbis. For example, take pretty much any Jewish literature in the ancient world, any Greco-Roman classical literature in the ancient world, there is a unanimous rejection of resurrection before the end of time. The only people who believed in resurrection at all were some sects of the Jewish community. And even then, they would never have held that someone would have been raised from the dead, resurrected, before the end of time. So this represents a completely dissimilar narrative relative to other rabbis. I mean, perhaps we might go to the claim, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, it's an extraordinary claim, sure. But I also think we have extraordinary evidence. I'd like to challenge Professor Atkins to give us any other example of a Jewish rabbi being hailed to be resurrected before the end of time. And if everyone fails to provide such an example, I think we have such examples of extraordinary evidence. Similarly, there are other marks of dissimilarity between Jesus' teaching and the Jewish context. For example, his teaching on the Son of Man. No one was ever really held to hold that position, and especially not in a way that Jesus was held to. No Jew expected a crucified Messiah. A Messiah in that context was someone who would liberate the Jews, who would go on a military attack against Rome. And Jesus is completely different to that. Anyone who made up these claims about Jesus' messiahship would have had him as a violent military leader. This is simply not what we see in the Gospels. We see him willfully dying at the hands of the Romans. And that's why we see in the Gospels the embarrassing details that the disciples fled afterwards, that they didn't know what to do, that they essentially gave up until they had these experiences and found the empty tomb, which, as I said, is agreed upon by the overwhelming majority of New Testament historians. Funny, there's a suggestion that people saw Elvis. Well, sure. I'd simply like to ask how many of them died for it. I don't know anyone that died for their belief in seeing Elvis after the dead. It seems to me a far simpler explanation than that they were lying. But this isn't a very good explanation in the case of Jesus, because they did die, and we have good evidence for that. We have evidence from Tacitus and other Roman historians and other writers very soon after the event. So again, I don't think this is very convincing, and I think you'll agree that theism is the best explanation. Thank you.
Not
sure I need all that, but anyway, we'll go ahead. I'm going to become a creationist, I've decided. It seems to me that a creationism, as an explanation for the physical world, deserves attention according to the view that you're putting forward. Why shouldn't creationism be regarded as a scientific theory on equal grounds to natural selection? I mean, if theism is going to be regarded as an equally likely, or in your view, better explanation, more of a simpler explanation than science, then creationism and all that nonsense should be allowed too. I'm not a creationist, really. I doubt whether anyone in this room would take it seriously. We know it's not science. We know the world doesn't, that the biosphere didn't come into its, didn't flourish in the way that creationists think. So the fact that someone comes up with a placard waving a theory does not mean that we should take it seriously, even though that placard might have been waved for 2,000 years, and that's what we've heard this evening. Seems to me that if we're going to follow logic, and I think that logic is an extraordinarily dangerous tool to use when talking about the nature of the universe, look where it got the Greeks. Not very far. I mean, you really have to go out and do experiments, compile theories, ensure that the theories are reticulations that fit together. If I were to use the same logic that we've been hearing this evening, that God is the ultimate simplicity, because that was the implication, surely God being the best of all possible things is the simplest possible entity. Now, the only thing that I can think of as being absolutely simple is nothing at all. Ergo, God is nothing and therefore doesn't exist. That's the kind of scholastic argument that we were hearing hints of this evening, and you can see the absurdity of it. Cullen said, this entity that does everything is extraordinarily simple. I just mentioned, I quote, a few characteristics. Yeah, what were those characteristics? Omniscience, omnipotence, could do absolutely everything, knew absolutely everything, could foresee the future, the past, was outside time. I mean, the God that Cullen is trying to propagate into your brains, that is, they're trying to act as an apologist for the last 2,000 years of obscurantist thought, is in fact the most complex entity it is conceivable to have. God is not an extreme simplicity. God is an absolute complexity, because only an absolute complexity can be infinite in all his attributes. Martyrdom. Yeah, I admit that people wasted their lives by dying for a cause in support of a belief. But the belief doesn't have to be true in order for you to commit yourself to it. Your belief doesn't have to be valid. It just has to be held very deeply and presumably sincerely. You do not have the entity in which towards which the belief is directed does not need to exist. And I think any psychiatrist will, once they have survived their own virgin birth, will probably agree with that. I think what you have to ask yourself is the following. Suppose we reversed history. Suppose that for some impossible reason, and this I admit is holy fantasy because we needed religion to act as the incubator for science, regrettable as that might be, but nevertheless, let's admit that that was the case, and so to some extent we have an obligation and a debt to religion. Suppose that for somehow science had come along first and religion got itself established in the 19th century. Would anyone take it seriously? Science would have got to the point that of providing explanations which were cogent, comprehensible, and respected the power of human comprehension, because people were able to say, yeah, if I work on it, I will begin to understand what you scientists are saying. And then along come the religious, and they say, you didn't need to do all that hard work. I've got a better explanation. God did it. Now, I think the people who would accept that would be classified as lazy, because it's so easy to lie back and pretend to yourself that you finally understand. And I think that's the context that you should see religion in. The fact that religion got into that position 2,000 years, 3,000 years, whatever, before science came along, it gave it a flying start, and it embedded itself in people's consciousness, in political systems, and in the polity of nations. But what science has got is trying to do is to say, false fare for 2,000 years. We are now providing something that, although it involves hard work, and certainly we don't have the arrogance, as the religious do, to say that we already understand how it all came about, that follow us on our journey towards understanding. Science respects the potential of the human mind, especially when it is acting cooperatively across boundaries, across lands, across time. Religion closes people's minds by saying, don't even trouble to try to understand this infinite incomprehensibility. You'll never succeed. Your brains are too puny. We scientists come along and give hope to humanity.
At the beginning of my opening speech, I said I'd give three main arguments for theism. These are from the order and the lawfulness of the universe, from the fine-tuning of the universe to permit life, and from the fact of Jesus' life and ministry. Now, it doesn't seem to me that any of the premises in these arguments have been rejected. We've heard a lot about alternative hypotheses and possibly simpler explanations, but we haven't really seen which of the premises have been rejected, and as long as we agree on the definition of evidence, which it seems we do, it seems to me that unless a premise is rejected, then these are inductively valid arguments, and so we should accept the conclusions. There is evidence for theism. No matter how strong or weak it is, there is evidence. Conversely, it doesn't seem to me that we've been presented with any particularly good arguments or evidence for atheism. There have been a few arguments, one of which was dropped, which was the argument that theism isn't necessary. Well,
I'm sorry, I never said that.
It seems to me that it was said that we don't need a God to explain things, that things can be done without science. If, as seems to be now the case, the implied conclusion wasn't that atheism is true, then I suppose we agree. So are there arguments that have been offered to think that atheism is true? It doesn't seem to me that there have been any valid ones, at least. One is that theism is a lazy explanation. Again, I responded to this. I said the fact that theism makes something more probable and is an explanation in some sense doesn't mean that we should stop looking. Indeed, I've argued consistently that theism actually gives the impetus for looking at science, for trusting in a rational world. It seems to me that on a purely atheistic hypothesis, this impetus doesn't exist at all. Indeed, Professor Atkins even admits himself elsewhere that his faith in science seems to be precisely that, a faith. He writes in his book On Being, recently published, "My own faith, my scientific faith, is that there is nothing that the scientific method cannot illuminate and elucidate. My faith respects the powerful ability of the collective human intelligence." And so I think, again, we're faced with the question, which worldview makes best sense of science? I've argued that not only does theism not prevent us from looking at the mechanisms, from looking at the science, it also gives us a reason to trust that science will work. On atheism, this doesn't seem to be the case. Hume's problem of induction still seems to stand, it seems to me. And Professor Atkins has admitted in his book, I think, perhaps it's hyperbole, perhaps it's ironically, but he has said that this is his own faith. It's his optimism that commits him to science rather than anything else. And so I think that argument still stands. There is one that perhaps I would agree with if theism was complex. Professor Atkins has argued that theism is complex and therefore improbable. I actually agree with this, and this is a generally accepted scientific principle that a simpler theory is more likely to be true. But again, it just simply doesn't seem to me to be the case that theism is a complex hypothesis. Professor Atkins has hinted at some reasons for this. Perhaps it's unbounded functionality or its infinite degrees of particular properties. But this doesn't seem to me to be a particularly insuperable obstacle. For example, suppose I told you that there was a tiny invisible particle which exerted a force on every other particle in the entire universe at infinite speed. According to Professor Atkins, this would seem to be an incredibly complex law, but I think it's actually a very simple law, and there's a law which says exactly that, and it was Newton's law of gravity. Now, although we know more about gravity now, we know more about general relativity, it still seems to me that that was a good law to have at the time. It was a simple law. I think infinite degrees of properties are actually simpler than large finite degrees. The latter call out for an explanation as to why there is a particular limit. Infinite degrees of properties seem to me to not have that difficulty at all. This is why the speed of light was held to be infinite, and so there was empirical evidence demonstrating otherwise. And so I'm not sure that infinity is any particular obstacle to our hypothesis simplicity. And so again, I think that argument is unsound. Professor Atkins has also alerted us to the dangers of logic. I'm not sure how this should really be addressed. All I would say is that obviously logic isn't enough by itself to know much about the world, and he's right about the Greeks not knowing too much about the world. But obviously this doesn't seem to me to be anything detrimental to logic or detrimental to my case. All I would say is that if we're throwing logic out, then we're in a very dangerous position. So I'll just end with thinking about what each of our worldviews commits us to. It seems to me that on my worldview, there is a God which explains multiple things. On Professor Atkins's view, there is trillions of universes. There are group hallucinations and lies, or whatever it might explain the resurrection facts. And it seems to me clear that theism is the simpler hypothesis. Thank you.
Professor Atkins, your closing speech. Again, we'll have 5 seconds on it.
Don't leave those 5 minutes. I know that those who believe in God will go on believing in God, and those who don't will, I hope, continue not to. I remind you that I actually introduced 6 arguments against the existence of God. Conveniently, 3 of those have been ignored in the course of this evening. So, but I won't bother to take umbrage at that. I think Cullen's last statement really said it all, that infinity is much simpler than anything finite, and therefore God must be infinite. You could take the opposite view. You could say that zero is much simpler than infinity. Therefore, I have proved that God doesn't exist, because all his attributes are negligible. they are all zero. You can play with words like that, and you can play with pseudo-logic like that, which is complete nonsense. I mean, what you have to do is to go out into the world and see how it works. And you can either start from a prejudicial point of view, which was something that emerged in, well, thousands of years ago, but let's pretend it was a Christian thing that emerged 2,000 years ago. And people made up all sorts of stories for their political ends, and they purported to support the view that there was an all-loving God who turned into his own son and then died, but then was born again. I mean, you have to take all this with a great pinch of salt, of course, but you can see the power of the analogies that emerge from that sort of thing. You can see how it grips people's minds. You can see how it grips the minds of societies. But it might all just be bunkum, and I'm afraid it is bunkum when you look at it through an unprejudiced eye. Or, instead of coming to these deep considerations with steeped in 2,000 years of cultural gravy, really, that you've been steeped in, along comes a new guy on the block, which says, let's go out and see what the world's like. And amazingly, by seeing what it's really like, doing experiments, setting up theories, talking to each other, not having prejudices, or if you do have prejudices, finding that they're quickly overthrown by the evidence, your humanity suddenly realizes that it can sniff out the truth. And when it sniffs out the truth, it finds that it doesn't need the concept of a god, a kind of supernatural being. It could discard that as a kind of crutch for the intellect that kept societies moving and kept investigation alive to some extent over a couple of thousand years. But it was seen to be scaffolding. The real way to the truth about the nature of the world is through the scientific method. A glorious method discovered, stumbled into by humanity, which provides something that is comprehensible to everyone, provided that they have the patience to listen. And indeed, I have to admit, to wait. But we've got a way of discovering the truth. And discovering the truth is not to resort to the books that were written 2,000 years ago. Thank you.
So that brings the formal part of our evening to a close. We're going to move quickly into a short period of discussion. So I just thought if we have some microphones, I'm just going to sort that out. I'll give the first question to Cameron since you're open. Actually, why don't you do that, please? So, Cameron, the first question I've got for you is, so you've come to this debate to defend the rationality of the position that God exists. And of Christianity in particular. But I wonder, isn't all this irrelevant? Isn't religion and your faith particularly all about faith and not about evidence?
I think this is a common misunderstanding of what Christians mean by evidence, well, at least what some Christians mean by evidence. I mean faith, sorry. It seems to me that the Greek word in the New Testament for faith, pistuo, I have faith in or I believe in, wasn't intended to imply a lack of evidence or anything like that. Rather, it was simply to say, I believe in it, or I place a particular trust or commitment to it. So, for example, the contrast that early Christians used when they said, I have faith in Jesus, was with the Roman kind of paradigm, I have faith in Caesar. Now, obviously, all the Romans had very good evidence for Caesar's existence. There were statues of him everywhere. There was a whole regime dedicated to him, particularly, or to whoever held the position at the time. And so it seems to me that that's not what a Christian means by faith. They mean they have a commitment in something which they think, at least, is based on evidence and based on a reasonable ground.
Okay, well, Professor Atkins, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I forget who it was who said that you can get real insight into that kind of answer by substituting the word superstition for faith. So wherever faith occurs in a sentence, in a book, wherever, simply substitute the word superstition. And you can see, for example, then the king or queen who is the defender of the faith becomes the defender of superstition. So, you know, they're the head of the church as a defender of superstition. Faith is all about superstition and nothing more.
I was
just wondering, I mean, I hinted at it in the debate, but you do write in your book, for example.
Someone read it, at least.
I did, a few times. But you say, my own faith, my scientific faith, is that there is nothing.
I was being ironical, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. but I mean, it's a different sort of faith. I mean, my faith is, let's come out into the open, let's call it faith, if you like, that I am an optimist about the work and about the scientific method. But I have got good reason to be optimistic about it. I know that the scientific method is extraordinarily powerful. It enables us to develop the technologies of the modern world, communication, transport, whatever. And it leads us into discovering the ultimate fabric of the universe, as far as we know. And I see no reason why we should think that the application of that method will ever run up against a brick wall. Now, your faith is based on water, basically. I mean, it has no firm foundation except sentiment.
Okay. I mean, there is a point, I think, perhaps, and it links into, I suppose, your views on science, which is to do with supersymmetry and beauty in science and that kind of thing. And it seems to me that you say, you say this in Galileo's Finger, one of your other books, if you relish beauty, you are probably inclined to believe that the universe is as beautiful as possible, and therefore supersymmetric. But then you also go on to say later on in the book, this kind of thing isn't enough insights, we need observation. And so it seems to me that is a perhaps an inconsistency there, and that you look for the most beautiful, the most profound, or...
No, I think what you do, you look for the truth, and then you take great satisfaction in discovering that it is beautiful.
Okay, well, I'd like to ask you, Professor Atkins, a question, and then maybe Cameron can then comment on that as well. So a big feature of what you were arguing tonight was about the power of science kind of eliminating the need to posit God as an explainer of these different data. And also, I guess, like what you said about logic and what that led to. So I wanted to ask you, just out of interest, do you think that the only things that we should believe about the outside world are those that can be scientifically demonstrated?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
I'll enrich that.
Okay.
That's going to be the end of the statement. By scientifically validated, it means if you go out into the world and do a series of controlled observations, and that is experiments, and you validate your expectations and so on, or you overthrow them and replace them by others. And then you find that other people do it and don't get the same answer. I mean, it's transnational, transcultural pursuit of the truth, and that's the pleasure of science. And so if you can't do that, and it turns out to be Mrs. Smith saying a virgin on the church symbol, church steeple, I don't believe that. I need to look into Mrs. Smith's brain before I started to know whether there was anything realistic that she'd seen. So science is, I think the scientific method, and don't interpret that as a cold, clinical look at anything. It's simply a way of collecting objective evidence and then setting it into a matrix of understanding of other theories.
Okay. Well, Calvin, did you want to comment on that position?
Well, it seems to me that there are at least a couple of things that I'm not sure science, in a particularly restricted sense, can really... Obviously, they can illuminate it, but I don't think they can really fully explain it. So, for example, well, not necessarily explain either, but tell us exactly the truth about it. So, for example, moral truths. How do you know that, for example, it's wrong to kill innocently? There's no really kind of observation you can make which automatically translates into a statement, you ought not do that. It seems to me that there's a gap there.
Which, of course, I raised in my initial presentation, and you then ignored. But I certainly take it up now, if you know.
The other one was simply deciding between two particular theories, both of which have the same empirical observations following from them. It seems to me that there's no...
Oh, but they don't. I mean, give me an example.
Well, an example in your opening speech was that perhaps creationism is a possibility, and it may be the case that God created everything 6,000 years ago with the appearance of evolution. It seems to me that if you expand that hypothesis enough, you get exactly the same empirical observations because the devil put fossils there, for example, or for some other reason. You have the same observations as if you believe in Darwinism.
Yeah, but science doesn't look at things in isolation. Okay, yeah, fossils are evidence of evolution, but there's a lot more that goes into understanding the fossil record, like plate tectonics, geological folding, and so on. So science is not a series of independent islands. It's a great congregation. It's a continent of knowledge.
I mean, it just seems to me, as I said, that if you elaborate the hypothesis enough, if you keep saying, well, God did this, God did that, God made plate tectonics, God did this, whatever, 5 seconds ago, that kind of thing, as long as you sufficiently elaborate that hypothesis, you have the same empirical content. And so it seems to me that you need some other guiding principle, such as simplicity, which I think we agree on. It seems to me that you need some other principle which can't be justified by observation.
To find simplicity.
Well, I mean, the definition I generally use is fewness of things in the Occam's razor kind of system.
So there's fewness of things, each of infinite power, according to you.
Well, there are other considerations. I mean, one of the, I think, things gaining traction in philosophy of science is the idea of fewness of independent adjustable parameters. And so, for example, if you have very few properties, like power, knowledge, it seems to me that that's a simple explanation of that.
Well, we just touched on the topic of morality, so I was wondering if we could... there's a famous passage from one of Richard Dawkins' books, which I want to quote from and see if you could both comment on it, since we just raised the topic of morality. So, Richard Dawkins writes, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, and other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless difference. So, Professor Atkins, would you agree with your fellow ideologue, if you like, Richard Dawkins, that in such a world there can't be any such thing as good or evil?
I didn't quite say that, of course. But I agree with the sentiment there, although I did say that in my remarks two things, that there is red in tooth and claw, which is our ecological history, where we have acquired ways of behaviour willy-nilly. But because we've got such big brains, in moments of quiet contemplation, not in the heat of the moment, maybe, then we can pour onto our red teeth and claws the milk of human kindness and think about the consequences of our action. And so the morality is the infrastructure provided by evolution with a kind of dressing, a softening, if you like, of intellect and consideration.
Yeah, well, Calvin, did you want to comment on the issue of morality in that situation?
I think one of the things I was wondering is it's not really clear whether you think morality is objective in that kind of sense, whether you think there are genuinely binding obligations that we have, such as you ought not to kill an innocent person, or whether morality is simply a descriptive fact saying, well, people generally don't kill because of evolution. I was wondering if...
It's a bit of both, as I tried to explain. On the whole, I don't know which direction my ethological history would drive me into thinking about whether killing someone is a good idea. Some people think it might be, so that depends upon the object. But on the whole, not. But I know that I'm deeply in the grip of my intellect, and I know that it would be inappropriate to start slaughtering people around me. So it's a mixture. I think what you have to do is to look at ethology across the entire biosphere, basically, to see how behaviour adapts and emerges. And then you have to look at anthropology to see how that sort of infrastructure has been modulated by experiments in social living, which leads to questions of morality.
Okay. And it just doesn't seem to me that there's a clear ground for that kind of obligation on atheism. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it seems to me that this is another date in which it fits better, I think.
But which God are you going to choose to guide you? I mean, you're going to choose your God of the New Testament, you're going to choose the God of the Old Testament, you're going to choose the God of Islam, you're going to choose the God of Scientology. Which God are you going to choose?
Well, I mean, I personally, being a Christian, I'd probably lean towards the Christian God. But I think it's important here to...
So you're making a judgment?
Well, I think it's important here to distinguish between the epistemological question of morality, which is to say how we know moral truth and how we know what's moral and that kind of thing, and the ontological question, which is to say how those moral obligations are founded, where they come from, and that kind of thing. And I think they're two completely separate questions.
So you think that ontologically they might come from Bibles?
No, I would say ontologically they would come from God, not from...
Whereas speaking through Bibles,
Well, yes, indeed. But it seems to me that, on your view, these kind of obligations, they're not clearly a descriptive fact about the way the world is. It seems to me that they're more an awkward ontological addendum that you have. Whereas for a theist, it seems to be quite easy to ground that in a person.
That's the trouble with theism. Everything is so blessed easy. I mean, all you've got to do is just to say, well, you know, God told us to behave like that. God did it. I mean, it is the easiest, most self-deceiving mode of understanding the universe that society has ever tumbled into. It really is extraordinarily easy.
Well, I think we're going to go to a short period of time for question and answer from the audience. So if you want to raise your hand if you have a question, but before I do that, I just said it'd be good if we don't have a back and forth between like one of the debates and someone from the audience. So if you could limit your questions to kind of one sentence questions, because we don't have too much time.
We'll give you one word answers.
Gentlemen.
Very powerful statement. You made several times you said that it's easy.
Is this the exact Professor Atkins?
Yeah.
I'll repeat the question.
Yeah, so you said several times it's very easy to adopt the faith position. From my point of view as a Christian, if your faith position is to mean anything at all, then your beliefs, your thinking should lead to actions. So would you consider that the sort of life that a Christian is being asked to live, which would arise out of their beliefs, the sort of life that Jesus lived, would you consider that was easy? Because I would say that's the heart of it. Not what's in our heads, but what it then leads us to do with our lives.
I'll just repeat the question. So the question was whether religion is so easy, or the God, but what about the kind of life that Jesus kind of calls Christians to? I guess it's not easy at all.
I think obviously not quite a number of Roman Catholic priests have shown it's not very easy at all to live by that particular set of precepts.
Do we have any? Yeah, the front row.
You were speaking about science and how it has a transnational component, which makes it more gives you more of a reason to believe in it. But you also said in your speech that it's not because something that has been around for 2,000 years and that billions of people believe in it that it gives you more of a reason to believe in it. But aren't those two statements kind of contradictory, that you would employ that for science but not for religion?
Okay, so I think the question is, you said one of the qualities of science is that it's transnational and that in some ways it's not bound at all by where you grow up. But you also said that truth is not a vote, or it's not achieved by popular votes.
Yeah, these have to be quick answers, of course, even though they might deserve much closer scrutiny. But religion is far from being transnational. I mean, if you'd been born in Saudi Arabia, you would have different views from wherever it is that you were actually born. I think religious truth is highly localized, whereas science is totally, totally transnational, transcultural.
But does that then contradict what you said about truth not being about whether it's global or universal, whether it's voted upon by everyone?
Oh, well, sorry, I'm getting confused by this conflation of ideas. What I said about that people don't vote on what is true or not. Science edges forwards by localized consensus that gradually spreads into the scientific community and does not conflict with the views that are held elsewhere. That's going a bit too far there, I think. But so there's an entirely different way of the propagation of change in science. And the part of the great strength of science is that it can be wrong. And it knows it can be wrong. And people make advances by discovering that it was wrong. That is not true of religion. You can't be wrong in religion. You can be
heterodox.
Yeah. So we've got two questions about it. I've certainly been wrong in my religious beliefs. I mean, you presumably think I'm wrong with all of them.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, my religious beliefs have changed loads during my time as a Christian, or time perhaps not believing that Jesus was God, and that kind of thing. And it's obviously there's not that attitude in some churches and some religious groups. There is kind of a hostility towards dissent or intellectual maneuver space. But for me personally, I don't find that there's any kind of problem with changing my beliefs. I try to do it in accordance with the evidence. Obviously, you disagree with my appraisal of the evidence, but certainly I don't think there's anything stopping me from changing my beliefs in that sense. But I just wanted to make...
There's plenty to stop me changing my beliefs. That's the difference, I think. I don't change my beliefs in science. I'm speaking of my scientific beliefs, simply as I grow older, because it's all a part of the network, the reticulation of ideas that constitutes modern science. And I can't blow in the wind.
Well, I mean, I've argued that I was the same with my religious beliefs. So, for example, I haven't always believed that Jesus was God, but looking at the evidence, what I thought was evidence and what I still do think is evidence, I came to believe that. And you can't say that was a brainwashing thing, because that was only a few years ago. I mean,
I think it could be a brainwashing thing, too. Yeah.
Well, there are a few more questions. There's one over there, Fez.
Yes, it's for Callum. You quoted quite a few atheist New Testament scholars in your resurrection evidence. I was just wondering why you think they're still atheists if they agree upon all the facts that you said were evidence for God.
Let me just repeat the question. So in your opening presentation, you quoted atheist historians as agreeing to certain facts that you're appealing to. But then, if they agree to those facts, why aren't they Christians?
I think there is always an element of subjectivity within scientific and historical investigation. And this is a point I think agreed on by probably most philosophers of science. There is that subjectivity. So sometimes theories with the same evidence will have different theories which explain them. And sometimes that can be easily determined in the case of perhaps six-day creationism versus Darwinism. Obviously, Darwinism is the simpler option. But in other cases, it's really quite hard to tell which is the simpler explanation. And I think there's an element of subjectivity, so I think that might account for part of it.
Sorry, can I interrupt you there? I don't wish to. But why is evolution the simpler one? Surely, with your omnipotent God, that is the simpler one.
Well, it seems to me that God would explain either mechanism for, as I said in my talk, saying that a God makes something more likely doesn't necessarily imply that we've given a mechanism for it, and I think the mechanism is still there to be exploited. And so we have to look at, within a theistic framework, I think, which explanation best makes sense of the data. And it seems to me that the fossil record and the genetics involved in evolution are very simply explained by theistic evolution and that kind of thing. Whereas the kind of assumptions you'd have to make to hold to creationism in light of those would be very complex. So not only would you have to believe that God existed, you'd have to believe that God wanted to create the world in 6 days. You'd have to believe that God wanted to put those fossils there, or that the devil exists and wanted to put those fossils there. And so it seems to me that both these options are available to the theist, theistic evolution or six-day creationism, or some in between. But it seems to me that out of those two options, Darwinism is by far the simplest, because it doesn't have to posit those extra addenda.
Well, if we stick, to this, go back to this question, so you get a chance to give your full price. So what is the objection, do you think, that like these atheist historians have, if they agree to the empty tomb, why are they not Christians then? What's their objection?
Well, I mean, it usually comes down to, so I said that most of these minimal facts are agreed on by the majority of atheist historians, like the empty tomb and that the disciples had particular experiences. What is disagreed upon is what explains those. And so, for example, Gerd Ludemann, one of the people I quoted earlier, says that the disciples must have just had hallucinations, which would explain it. But it seems to me that that explanation is just as miraculous, in a sense, or just as supernatural as the theistic one, because as far as I'm aware, there haven't really been any particularly veridical or reliable studies showing that group hallucinations occur. So I think either way you have to say, look, this is something that hasn't happened before. This is something completely alien to us, completely new to us, and which is the simpler explanation. And it seems to me, well, you'll know what I'd say there, but those are kind of the reasons they give alternative explanations, which I think are just as supernatural. And so I don't think appeals to science or naturalism will help us there. I think we have to look at what we really think is the simplest. And group hallucinations, they've never been observed. They're equally flawed in that capacity. And it seems to me a more complex hypothesis.
Should we go to our next question, or did you want to comment?
No, we'll talk about mass hallucination.
Okay, well, how about right at the back on the left there? Yes.
Yeah, I have a question for Professor Atkins, because I hear simple explanations. If you talk about an inquisitive child that goes to, you know, a priest and says, where do I come from? He says, God did it. And I go to, like, a teacher, and the teacher says, your parents did it. I mean, the teacher's obviously telling the truth. I mean, my parents did do it. No pun intended. But, you know, that's a non-trivial explanation of where I come from. If I'm a persistent child, I can ask, well, what did my parents do? You know, how did I come about? And my teacher would probably be a bit embarrassed at that point. But it seems to me that just saying my parents did it is not a stopping point. I mean, it's true that my parents did it. They did something, and thankfully I don't know what it is now, but, you know, just saying my parents did it and you know, stopping there, if my teacher is too embarrassed, isn't to tell an untruth, nor is it to end the inquiry. So it's not lazy. It's an explanation, it's a good explanation, it's a simple explanation, but it's not the whole picture. But you seem to say that in any religious sense is just totally wrong. And I'm just wondering why you do that, and why you think it's the analogy.
Okay, so it's basically an analogy to contest what you said about simplicity. So I think the question is, so just because I might ask my teacher, why is it that I'm here? And my teacher could say, parents did it. But that just because they say parents did it doesn't mean it's a stopping point, because it doesn't say what the mechanism was or exactly how that happened. So why can't we apply that to religion when we say God did it? But that's not lazy, because you haven't necessarily had to appeal, like just said, there's no...
Well, it's a slogan rather than an explanation.
Well, so I think to the question, would you then say that parents did it as just a slogan?
Yeah, not clearly. They're trying to evade the pursuit of truth. If they were, you know, infinitely benign parents, then they would presumably say, now ask the next question. And the child would pursue the truth. And that's what scientists do. They don't stop at, you know, these a Muslim war, as it were.
Right, but I think what his objection is that, well, actually, that's the theist agrees with you and says that exactly, so we don't stop with God did it. That gives an explanation, but then we look for the mechanism. And so it's not lazy, because we then say, let's find the mechanism.
But you don't tell me what the mechanism was that God used.
Well, what kind of job?
I mean, just waiting to think that. That's great.
To do what? How did God do what? I mean,
anything.
Well,
I mean, it's ludicrous to say that God did it. I mean, did it just lie there dreaming you up, or dreaming it and causing it? Was it a causal? Well, I mean, to say that God did anything is an abnegation of the intellect.
Well, do you think it's, whether you think it's a stopping point of inquiry or not, do you think it's true to say that this gentleman's parents did it? Do you think it's true to say that they exist?
Well, I have to take his word that...
there was no magic word.
Some kind of bastard.
So purely you do think it's true, but what would you cite in support of that view? What evidence is there that he exists? Well, that his parents met?
Oh, I accept that, you know, he exists, that he had parents. I don't know who they were. I presume that you do, at least. And I presume that they believe that you are their offspring. But where is that getting us?
Well, okay, so I think from the question, I think what he's saying is that we've established from looking at him, there's a person here, therefore there must be parents. But that's not lazy, because we haven't found out the mechanism for how that happened. And so the question is, why is that not analogous with religion? We see the certain questions we're looking at, therefore God exists, but we then look and do science for the mechanism. I think it's the question.
But why do you
want to get one final response, then that'll be it.
Why do you need to posit a God behind those questions? You don't. I mean, the whole point of modern science is to find mechanism in the absence of deity. And it's succeeding extraordinarily well.
Okay, well, I think we'll stop there because we've run out of time. But I think we'll all agree it's been a fantastically challenging, profitable, and enjoyable evening tonight. So would you join me in thanking our two debaters for kindly being willing to engage? Nardi for organising this event. This whole event was his brainchild, so we show our appreciation to him as well. And finally, I'd like to thank you for coming, especially for those who came from outside of Oxford, just for this debate. And thank you for being an excellent audience. It's been a real privilege to be part of this. Do check back on the event page on Facebook to link to the recording. There hopefully will be a video on YouTube. Which you'll probably find there. So thanks again. I hope you have a good evening.
Well, that was the debate. Hope you enjoyed it. Obviously, some slides were used there by Callum, and I do encourage you, if you want to see the nature of those slides during that debate, you can, of course, go to the video link, which I'm providing with the podcast of this programme, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. So I wonder what you thought of that. Do feel free to email in your comments, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Next week, in the next show at least, it's back to the normal format, and we'll be getting some of your feedback, especially to the last couple of weeks of programming and indeed the conference. But yes, be happy to receive your thoughts on this as well as, of course, on the Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, twitter.com/unbelievablejb, if you want to get in touch with me by either of those routes too. Okay, well, let's hear some of the reactions of some of those who came along to see the debate, and indeed those who took part in the debate. And we begin with the atheist in the debate, Peter Atkins.
How did you think the debate went?
I think, obviously, my opponent was very well informed and very articulate, and a pleasure to attack. Of course, he is imbued, he's marinated in Christian belief. And so once people are marinated, it's very hard to get them to float to the surface.
He did say, though, that his belief in Jesus as God, which is obviously what defines someone really as a Christian, is only something that he's believed in recently.
Well,
on the basis
of evidence. He didn't quite say that. He said he changed his ideas about a number of aspects of Christian belief. Mm. He didn't say that he came to it from an atheist or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what about yourself, though? I mean, one could say that you're marinated in atheism.
The stew that I emerged from was the Church of England.
Right.
When I was an unthinking child. Mm. And once you start to think, you can see that, benign as some of its members are, that the truth does not reside in it.
I mean, obviously, Callum believes that the arguments he presented are good evidence for God. You often dismiss them as there being no evidence whatsoever, but surely you must admit that there is evidence.
Well, there is certain evidence that the Gospels were written by people with a certain political interest well after the events that they purport to describe. So is that evidence?
Well, I suppose you then go on to debate whether that is the case and whether they are an objective account of the fact of what happened to Jesus Christ. I mean, we debate the evidence one way and the other.
Yeah.
I suppose the question is, you act as though anyone who believes in God is being lazy. That was sort of the watchword, really, of the evening, laziness.
Yes.
And I just feel that Callum isn't lazy in his beliefs.
I did not say it is lazy. I don't think the word lazy came through my lips.
It came through a couple of times, the word lazy, yes. So I think the point
is...
point is, obviously Callum's thought through, well-reasoned arguments, however much you may disagree with them, they're not the product of laziness, are they?
Oh, no. I don't accuse St. Augustine of laziness. No, I misguided this, yes. But not laziness.
Good. Okay. Well, in any case, it was a very enjoyable debate. Thank you for being with
us. Okay, my pleasure.
And Peter's wife was next to him, reminding him that he had used the term lazy once or twice during the debate. In any case, John and Lucy also attended to watch the debate. Here's what they thought about the evening.
John, what did you think of the debate this evening?
I thought there were good points made from both sides, but there wasn't really anything particularly new or what I thought was something to get excited about. I thought it was not in a bad way, but it was almost the debates we've heard before again. And it's almost as if there's no resolution to it.
Yeah. You're a Christian.
Yeah.
Do you base your faith on any of the arguments that Callum has put forward tonight?
Yeah, I do now. I started off emotionally believing in God, but then when I became 16 to 18, I started to think about it properly. I think then everything just became reasonable choices until now. Yeah.
Is it enough to convince someone who maybe has come from an atheist perspective? I mean, it's very hard to see how Peter Atkins will ever get convinced by Callum's arguments, however well he presents them
in this kind of
forum.
That rational kind of argument is only effective if it comes with an emotional response as well, because as we've seen, it's quite reasonable to be an atheist. So unless there's an emotional reason, you've experienced something, there doesn't always seem to be a big enough reason. If you don't believe in God,
what's the value of these kinds of debates then, as far as
I think it shows that Christians aren't all nutters. Actually, we are reasonable. This is something that's okay to believe.
It's an intellectual option,
and it means that parents of sons of atheist parents, perhaps, who've grown up thinking that, oh, this is all rubbish and stuff like that, will actually start seeing us as intellectual people who can defend ourselves and believe.
But it can't just be an intellectual assent that makes.
No, I don't think so. I think it could be, but it wouldn't particularly be very strong when a parent falls ill or something like that.
Thank you very much, John.
That's all right.
Thank you. Lucy?
Hi.
Hi. So what did you make of tonight's debate? Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was really good, actually. I mean, I think some of the points were quite typical points to make, but I thought both of them dealt with it quite well, especially Callum, because it's his first debate and everything. So, I thought he dealt with it really well, considering Professor Atkins is probably a lot more experienced with debates and stuff like that. So I thought it was quite good.
You're also a Christian. I mean, how valuable for you is these kinds of discussions, these
definitely
arguments?
Definitely. I think it's obviously important to have a relationship with God, but I think you do need to be rational about it as well and have, you know, some kind of logic behind it. Mm. And, you know, being at college, I quite often get questioned about it, and I think just a kind of, you know, Jesus loves you sort of answer isn't really enough. Mm. You kind of need a bit more of a rational answer to, you know, just kind of show why you believe in stuff, really.
I mean, one thing I was just asking Peter Atkins just now, he mentioned a few times that just positing God as an explanation is just lazy, because you kind of just... It's no explanation at all. It's just too easy to do that. Do you think? What do you make of that point of view that it's laziness at the end of the day?
Well, I think it's probably more logical than saying that there isn't a God. I mean, I think it would be lazy to assume that, you know, God isn't proved. You know, we can't prove the existence of God, so therefore he doesn't exist. I think that's probably lazier. Mm. You know, we've kind of, as Christians, we've taken the further step and kind of tried to explain it more than just saying, oh, it's nothing because we can't prove it, science can't prove it.
Well, thank you very much.
That's all right.
Dill was one of those in the audience watching. Here's his thoughts on how the evening went.
So, Dill, what did you think of the debate tonight?
I thought it was feisty.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it did move on to different territory than the recent debates I've seen, certainly Peter Atkins do, with Bill Craig.
Mm. He didn't pull out the old, there's positive and negative energy, so there's really nothing here argument this time around.
No, he didn't, no. I thought the starting point, Callum tried to start in a different place, which was, have we got evidence for a particular hypothesis? And to me, that is a different starting point from the recent debates. I thought it ended up more or less in the same place, but I thought there were new things that I heard, and I thought that it was a real exchange that they really did engage, and I thought it was very interesting.
I mean, in a way, fair play to him. It was Callum's first ever debate, really. Atkins obviously done this a few times.
Yeah.
So what did you think of Callum as a sort of prospective, you know, apologist and all the rest of it?
I thought he was really good. I mean, you can do, you know, an opening talk, and that's one level of expertise, but then within a minute or two to come back at somebody else from their things, that requires sort of an agileness of thinking he did really well, and and there was that real engagement, not just talking past one another three times in a row. And so
you had a question to ask Atkins. He said it's too easy, Christianity, God as an explanation, too easy.
Yeah.
You wanted to ask, essentially, well, it's not actually easy when you actually put it into practice.
Yeah, I mean, what I get from Professor Atkins is that one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, that he dismisses Christianity is that he considers it's too easy, it's lazy. And what I was trying to say was that it's not just what you think, but that what you think commits you to actions and an entire life. And the life that those beliefs would lead you to is anything but easy. So that maybe he's dismissing it for less than good reasons.
Well, thank you very much.
I also caught up with Mahmoud, who was the person who put together the debate in the first place.
Mahmoud, you were the one who kind of facilitated tonight's debate.
Yes.
What's the purpose of this debate? Is it the first time that academics and students have debated in a sort of public forum?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was kind of struck when I used to kind of watch these debates on YouTube, and I'd see kind of people, peers, commenting and saying, you know, oh, well, you know, this objection was poor, this argument was poor. So I kind of thought, why not give students an opportunity to debate academics, and we'll see if they, you know, if they can really stand up to it.
So you're hoping to possibly carry this on in other ways?
Yeah, future? I think the first event has been a real success, so I'd definitely like to kind of do something again. Soon.
And how did you arrive on Callum as being the person to propose the motion that God does exist?
Well, I asked around, Callum was I knew Callum anyway, and I know that he's very skilled at apologetics, and when I asked for other people's opinions, they also recommended Callum. So I thought Callum certainly, and he was certainly very up for it when I suggested it to him.
And fair play to Peter Atkins for being willing to
definitely. I really didn't think like a big fish like Peter Atkins would come. I kind of emailed him and just kind of like, you know, wouldn't it be nice? But I think it's fantastic of him to show up and kind of support students in this way.
And do you take any particular side in this particular debate, or are you here just sort of purely for
personally interest? I'd say I'm atheist / kind of agnostic, veering towards atheism.
Right.
But having said that, I really dislike poor atheist arguments. Mm. So I kind of, in this particular debate, I enjoyed the caliber of debating between the two. And I really can't say who won out of the two. I think they both presented some brilliant arguments.
Finally, I spoke to Callum Miller himself. Here's what he had to say about the debate. I asked him firstly whether he'd been nervous preparing for it.
I was quite nervous, I guess. I mean, I haven't really done any formal debates before, so this was quite a big thing, and especially with such a long thing and only me and Professor Atkins debating, it was quite a big thing. I mean, I'm confident in my arguments, and obviously I believe it genuinely, so in that sense I wasn't particularly nervous, and I think probably I came across as confident enough to be persuasive, I think.
I think it's always a big leap from the, you know, making your arguments from behind the comfort of a computer screen to doing it in a live setting, you know, which with all that entails. But I think you did a great job.
Thank you.
And well done.
Thank you.
So how did you feel it went overall?
I think it went okay. It was very different to what I anticipated, because I prepared a whole load of notes, but just the time in the debate, there wasn't really much time to refer to them. Yeah. And so I had to do most of it just from memory and kind of very on the spot. And also it's quite difficult that the time period gets shorter each round, where the issues open up and it should really get longer. but it was hard, especially when you got near to the end and you had to summarize everything and rebut things at the same time. It was quite a struggle, but I think I did well enough to be proud.
Atkins, did he bring anything to the discussion that you hadn't been expecting? Anything different? I know you probably listened to just about every debate you could lay your hands on that he's done, but was there anything that kind of caught you by surprise?
Not really that I know of. He used a very similar speech in his opening speech to one he'd used before. And I think the arguments were generally the same. So I'd had a little bit of time to kind of think about them. But there were no major surprises, I don't think. The main surprise was how the debate actually worked and how little time you had. I don't think anything particularly surprising from him.
You were telling us you're going into psychiatry, and possibly in the future. What role does... Obviously, you've got a really good grasp of these arguments, Callum. You seem to be pretty passionate about apologetics. Do you see this as being a sort of side venture in your life, or could it take over and become the thing that you do? How do you see the future evolving from here?
I actually prefer philosophy to medicine in terms of content. So
I certainly haven't seen you do many medicinal debates online, mainly philosophical ones.
Well, I've got my medicine finals in 3 weeks, so we'll see how that those go. Possibly not too well. But I have actually applied for a PhD in the philosophy of science.
So,
I really do want to kind of make this a full-time thing. Obviously, I'll start off as a doctor working full-time and doing as much philosophy and theology as I can. But I'm hoping to eventually maybe do medicine work part-time or kind of enough to get me by and then do philosophy as much as I can. I really want to get into academia in those channels.
Well, all the very best for that. And if tonight's anything to go by, I think there's a very promising future there.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to today's programme. Hope you've enjoyed it. Sorry again that it was a little bit late out compared to the usual weekly nature of the Saturday podcast, but going to be back in a few days' time as we return to our normal format of programming with a more Christian, non-Christian debate, and of course we'll be releasing over the next few weeks some of the material from the last week or so where we've had Hugh Ross and Ken Samples in conversation in various ways with people like atheist scientist Lewis Wolpert at Imperial College, the old earth, young earth creation debate that they had recently at Gunnersbury Baptist Church, and indeed some of the material from the conference itself, which we'll be putting out on a podcast soon as well. So expect all of that in your podcast feed pretty soon, as well as an interesting discussion coming up that we're going to be airing on immortality. Stephen Cave, philosopher, writer, in conversation with Roger Harper, a Christian, on the concept of why we want to live forever. So all of that to look forward to, and I hope you'll come back to enjoy that. You know where to come if you're online. It's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until next time, have a good week.